a world filled with fast-paced living and constant demands on the aging body, it's easy to forget some of the simplest yet most essential elements of our well-being: hydration and nutrients. As you know, when I'm not in the studio recording a podcast or in the gym or out in the scrub hunting, putting rounds down range, I'm somewhere in the world on a security gig, putting in the hard yards, ending up on TikTok. So the legends that get some keep me advancing forward: Jocko Fuel Supplements. More specifically, I've been smashing the Jocko Hydrate Sachets, which helps me replenish my electrolytes and other critical vitamins while boosting energy and supporting recovery. Also, just like my kids, my appetite for veggies goes as far as hot chips from the Colonel. However, every morning I'll mix a scoop of Jocko Greens Jocko Creatine into water, which helps me supplement my lack of and delivers all the nutrients for better gut health, immune support, cognitive function, and physical performance. And not to mention, tastes bloody good. So head over to www.getsome.com.au and use the code ZEROLIMITS all in caps for a discount. I'll leave you with this for the day: hard work, clean fuel, stronger, faster, smarter, better. Let's go.
You're listening to a Zero Limits podcast brought to you by Two Ravens Tactical. Your hosts are Australian veterans Matt and Shane, and we're here to give you the motivation to accomplish any goal you set your mind to. On these podcasts, we're going to be speaking to high-charging people with a zero-limit mindset that never say no. Let's go.
Yeah, right, Shane. Well, this one's pretty cool for us because being Novocastrians. Yeah, I'm an adopted Novocastrian.
Yeah, you are.
I am Brisbane through and through, but I live here and I've been here for a very long time now. And we've got to chat to, you know, it's funny because we spoke about trying to find someone, a fighter pilot that was, you know, flew in Baghdad and basically someone that's dropped bombs on bad people.
Yeah.
And turns out we do have one here in Newcastle, which, you know, of all people, he is also
right under our noses.
Yeah, right under our noses. He is the best pilot in the world when it comes to Red Bull air race.
Yeah, he's a reigning, he'll be the forever world champ of Red Bull because it finished in 2019.
So. Yeah. So just have a listen in and we're pumped for this one.
Happy days. Season on the other side.
Let's go. So Shane, on today's podcast, we have someone, he's a Novocastrian.
Yes.
Which is a good thing.
Born on the west side of Lake Macquarie as well.
We're not going to say where because he doesn't want us to say.
Matt Hall, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
And here we are at Matt Hall's place of work, his office at Matt Hall Racing.
Yeah, it's our global headquarters. used to be Aero Pelican, and that's now we've renamed it to Lake Macquarie Airport just to capture the region a bit more.
I love it here. It's good.
Yeah, right. Well, I guess let's just start from the start. You know, yourself, you know, where you grew up and, you know.
even though you don't want to say.
Some of our listeners are from that area too. So
I might
give them a bit of inspiration actually.
I've got to make sure I don't bag it out too much. But in fact, yeah, so I actually in my kindergarten days, I was actually at Swansea and used to fly at this airfield actually with my dad. My dad's a pilot as well. And I used to come out here as a kid and fly planes out here at the Aero Pelican airfield. But halfway through primary school, we bought a small farm out at Mandalong and I moved internationally to western side of Lake Macquarie.
Yeah, right.
And I went to school at Morisset High School. So, definitely I'm as local as you can get around here at Lake Macquarie. And
that's awesome.
And I thought I had escaped, but I'm back here.
Morisset too.
From flying all over the world and like the lifestyle you've had, you know. Morisset 2283, is it the postcode? Morisset?
Yeah, I think we were 2288. Oh man, no, 2264 is what I was at.
If we were at a party, Matt, we would have had beef.
Yeah. Toronto.
Toronto 2283.
Yeah, exactly.
So you grew up at Morisset. Your father was a pilot and he used to bring you to work, obviously. That's how you got your passion.
Yeah, well, he was and still is a recreational, like a general aviation pilot. So he was an engineer down at the power stations, actually, at Vales Point.
Okay.
But he used to fly on weekends. So it was he'd drag me out. You know, I'm not sure initially if I was, you know, I was the guy that wanted to go with Dad to go to the airport or whether it was like, well, I'm going flying and I've got to look after the kid for the day, so you are coming with me.
Yeah.
But, it's how it all sort of kicked off as, initially. And then, I'd be begging, you know, let's go flying. So that's where I got my passion was from flying planes, was from my dad.
Happy days. And then what age did you decide to join the RAF?
Well, it was actually I was just finishing up school, and I knew I wanted to be a pilot, but it's an expensive trade to learn.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
And I was already flying, you know, gliders and ultralights and hang gliders off jumping off the cliffs at Merriweather as a teenager, and I just went and started getting my pilot's license and ran out of money because, you know, I was trying to work a job part-time and pay for flying, and it just wasn't happening. And I started thinking, you know what, I'm not going to be able to chase my dream of being a pilot for a career. And, I had this realization that most adults you see them, they hate life. You know, they live for the weekend. It's like, why would you do that? You know,
yeah.
This is not a dress rehearsal. It's your one shot at having a great life. And I knew I had to do something with my life that was that I'd leapt out of bed for.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to jump out of bed looking forward to the day as opposed to, you know, dreading the day. And it occurred to me the Air Force would offer that up. They'd train me, they'd pay me, and you'd get to fly some pretty cool stuff. But you know, like a lot of people, you mentioned military and you're like, well, you know, that's a big commitment. You know, yes sir, no sir, marching, getting your lad, all that sort of stuff. It's like for a kid from Morissette, that's like, oh, I'm not sure I could handle
it's
that.
Huge.
But I thought, what's the worst situation? The worst situation is to get to 30 and still have done nothing with my life.
Yeah.
And I thought that's a scarier thought. So let's have a crack at it right now while I'm young.
Exactly. What year did you enlist?
January 91. In fact, January 17th, I was in the recruiting centre at in Sydney signing on the bottom line, and we got evacuated because it was the exact same day that the bombing started in Kuwait and Gulf War One.
Really?
So, I was signing on the line, and then some dude in Air Force uniform, I don't know what rank he was because I didn't know anything about the Air Force at all at that point. Some dude walks in and goes, hey, we've got to evacuate. There's been a bomb threat, and the US has just started bombing Kuwait to force Iraq out.
Oh, shit.
And we can tear your contract up right now if you don't want to continue. And I'm like, sounds like an adventure. Let's go.
So what did you
Yeah. All right, no worries.
it's funny though how you say that, because the reason why I joined was because of 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, and it was the adventure, and like, oh shit, we're going to Afghanistan or Iraq. Let's go.
Exactly. And you want to do something. Yeah. That's not right. There's the movie Sniper, and in that he's either he's talking to his son or his dad's talking to him, and he says, you know, there's three types of people in the world. There's wolves, there's sheepdogs, and there's sheep.
Yeah,
and you got to pick which you are. And I'm a sheepdog, you know. Yeah. So I got to keep the wolves at bay, and I got to look after the flock. And so you see things like 9/11. You go, what are you? You go, I'm a sheepdog, and sign up, put yourself in harm's way to keep the sheep safe. And that's just who military people are.
Yeah. So when you joined the Air Force, what did you join as initially?
Straight in as a pilot. So there's two ways into the military as an officer. There's as a pilot. There's through ADFA, go get a degree and then go on pilot training. Or there's what they call direct entry, which is at the time when I did it, it was 13 weeks of officer training. We learned to march, learned to salute. I had no idea. I was calling sergeants sir, and they were kicking my ass. God, I work for a living, don't call me sir. And I'm like, oh, I don't get this. So 13 weeks of that, and then straight into flying training. So 18 months after signing on the dotted line in July 1992, I graduated with my wings as the ducks of my pilot's course, and was streamed straight off that onto fighters.
Happy days. Awesome. Yeah. Sorry, was your training, was that up at Tamworth back in that day?
No, Tamworth didn't exist as a training establishment. It existed, obviously, but not as an Air Force training establishment. Yeah. So I was straight down to Point Cook, did my officer training and my initial flying training down at Point Cook at Melbourne. And then halfway through that, you get then transferred over to Pierce over at Perth, and finished off my training there on PC-9s for the second half of the course.
Right. So Tamworth, is that just for helo pilots, is it?
No, the Air Force then started training there actually. Okay. So it would have been in the late 90s, early 2000s sort of time frame. So after my time doing that sort of stuff. They were initially, it was just screening. People would go there and be weirded out, you know. It's like, you want to be a pilot, just go and flight. No, sorry, son, you haven't got what it takes. But then it turned into actually a training establishment for all pilots.
Yeah, so how was the training to become a pilot through the Air Force? Was it, you know, labour intensive? Was it?
It was stressful. Like, and you know, there's reasons for it. You know, they want to put people under stress and see how they go.
Of course,
like the classic military training is you've got to load people up more than they would in real life, so that you see how they respond in training, and you go, well, you know, you, you know, if you're getting stressed and can't do it because your instructor's yelling at you, how are you going to do it when there's rounds in the air? So a lot of people really suffered in the training mentally, and a lot of people got washed out. You know, we had 20 people start on my pilot's course and only 8 graduated. Yeah, so it's right. fairly large scrub rate.
Yeah, it's coal.
Yeah, but I actually, believe it or not, really enjoyed my pilot training. Like, I'm a bit unique in that way, I think, because every other pilot I talk to, they go, man, I hated pilot's course. I'm like, man, it was so cool. Like, here I was, you know, I'm 19 years old, getting given an Air Force aircraft and they're paying me to do it. It's like, exactly it's right. like, oh, you know, most people would cut off their, cut off some limb to go for a ride. And here they are paying me money to fly on these planes. So I just couldn't get enough of it. And when pilot school's finished, I'm like, oh, okay, well, what's the next challenge now? And,
yeah.
I guess that's how you become good at something, is you don't back away from challenges. You look to embrace challenges because it's an opportunity to be better.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I looked at it. And, you know, I worked really hard but I played hard and I got great results doing it as well.
And how many hours did you need to do to pass pilot training in a way? And what type of planes were they?
Yeah. So we're flying CT-4s initially, which are just little piston aircraft. And then we went on to the PC-9, which is like the roulettes were flying until just recently, turboprop. And from memory, it was about 150 hours of flying. So not a lot of flying. But it's more of the, you know, there's a lot of academics, a lot of, you know, like really making sure.
Calculations.
Yeah, exactly. And you're not going to use a PC-9 operationally, but what they needed to make sure is that, you know, can you learn this plane, like, so you can pull it apart blindfolded with a Meccano set, screwdriver, so that you can then say, righto, this guy's good at what he does and he's committed to what he does, so we can afford to put him onto Hornets and invest the money in Hornets. Whereas, you know, you go, hey, you can fly the PC-9 all right, but he's not interested in how it works. He's not interested in how to get the most out of it. Yeah, well, why do we invest money in putting him into a $50 million fighter?
Yeah, well, $50 million fighter.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, this is an expensive machinery. So, you know, you finish your pilot training, then you get posted to a squadron. Where would you get posted?
Yeah, so when you graduate of pilot's course and you get streamed to fighters, you then got to do a jet conversion because you're flying a turboprop. You know, so it's got a prop, but it's got a jet engine in it. Yep. So onto the Mackie, which was in Perth, in Pierce still, and then came over to Williamtown to then fly the F-18. So I did my F-18 conversion, which is a six month course learning how to be safe. You learn tactics, but you're not really a tactician, or they wouldn't even take you to war. Like, it takes another 12 months in the squadron before you go to war. And I finished up there, did two tours, one at 77, one at 3 Squadron here at Williamtown. And then I was selected to go on our, on what we call Fighter Combat Instructor course, which is our version of Top Gun, another 6 month course.
Yeah, right.
Basically, you know, no kidding, the best of the best go and just really get everything you can out of yourself, your team, the whole ADF.
Yeah, Matt, right.
And that's based out here in Newey?
Exactly. Yep. So that's also based here at Williamtown. Yeah, yeah, so cool. I joined the Air Force to see the world and just spent my
stuck in Morisset.
Yeah. Pretty much. I now call myself from Merriweather.
smart man.
What was your, you know, the first time you got into a fighter jet, you know, F-18,
Yeah, what was going through your head?
Obviously, you're flying props at that stage.
How old were you, though, Matt, when you jumped in the Hornet?
I was 20.
Jesus 20 Christ, years old, mate. Straight into a $50 million machine.
When I was 20, I think I just started to dive in the Navy as well and shooting guns, and I was like, this is fucking sick. And you're 20, you're flying a $50 million jet by yourself, you know.
Yeah. In fact, I was probably 21. I've just got to try and do some maths, but
21 years old.
Yeah, so I was actually older than that. I was super old.
isn't it bizarre, like, the Defence Force just put so much trust in their soldiers, sailors, airmen, officers?
It's great, isn't it? Yeah, it's great. And you know, I guess it's not at the drop of a hat, and it's not overnight. You know, at this stage, they know me for, I've been in the force for 2.5 years. So you've got 2.5 years of written material on you. Like, this guy's trustworthy or he's not. You know, this guy applies himself or he doesn't. This guy makes safe decisions when it all goes to shit, you know. So it's one of those things, and there's people that they'll never hand over the keys to, and there's young people they do. But it was pretty cool though. My first three flights, I don't remember a great deal about them because you're so focused, because it's like, I'm getting in an F-18, it's a two-seater, you got an instructor in the back, and you know, you just, but from day one, you have to fly as captain. So he's there to help you, But you're not sitting there going, okay, instructor, what do I do now?
Yeah.
He goes, here's what we're going to do. And then you get in there and do it. And he's there and assessing you and teaching you. But the fourth flight you do is solo. So it's your first flight out there in an F-18 on your own. And they gave me a single seater. So, you know, most the operational jets are single seaters. So it's the first time getting in a single seat, $50 million supersonic jet fighter.
Yeah.
You know, in my,
that is cool.
At that age. And I was just like, man, how good is this? And I just remember taking off at straight out over the ocean at Williamtown. And it's the first time I relaxed because, you know, that generally the guy in the back and you're like, you know, just focused doing everything.
Yeah.
Took off and I'm like, okay. And I looked back as Stockton Beach was disappearing and Newcastle disappearing that way. And I'm doing like 500 knots heading out to sea. And I look back and then I go, holy shit, I'm in an F-18. Yeah. And it's the first time I've looked back and the wings are like 20 meters behind you. You know, you're out on this pointy nose and the wings are 20 meters behind you and the tail's way back there. And you're like, this is a massive aircraft. Yeah. The profiles, you get up, unload and go supersonic. So, I am supersonic in an F-18 going, how good is this? And that's when you go, geez, I'm glad I made that decision 3 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
I could have been working in a bank now.
We were working at Coles. just going back, before you jump into the actual craft, is there like a simulation you go to, like to learn all the buttons and gadgets?
Yeah, exactly. Heaps of sim stuff. So what sims are, you know, back then were good for, and sims now are amazing for everything, but back then the sims were procedural trainers. So practicing all your emergencies mainly because, you know, you don't want to actually set an aircraft on fire to make sure you can put it out. So you'd just be doing emergency after emergency after emergency of practicing, engine fire drills and, landing gear drills and engine failure drills and flight control failure drills and all that sort of stuff. And just because, you know, when you go out there on your own, it's like no one else is going to dig you out of this problem. If I get a fire or lose an engine or flight control, it's like, dude, you're 21. You better not screw this up.
It's funny in a way because when the officer, the watchers come to our ships, you know, they're probably at the same age, you know, the sub-lieutenant level, and they sort of think they're cock of the walk, you know, they're in charge of like a warship worth, you know, how much money, in charge of everyone's lives, and they're out in like a night watch, and I'm just like, oh, yeah, that's pretty cool. And sitting here now, you're like, yeah, I'm only 21 flying this $50 million jet by myself. Oh, I love it.
There's people say, you know, fighter pilots are arrogant, and I don't think there's some that are, obviously, and like you're talking about there, there's some arrogance with the sub lieutenants that are coming on. But in the end, what I tell people about the military in general is it's not arrogance, it's confidence. And the difference between arrogance and confidence is confident people listen to advice but go about with absolute belief in their ability.
Yeah.
Whereas arrogant people go about things with absolute belief in their ability, but stiff arm anyone saying, this is how you could do it better.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. And you'll never meet a fighter pilot who says, I don't want to know, because you know they don't actually make it through training.
Yeah.
They'll get weirded out and kicked out because can't afford people like that. So that's why, you know, I tell all my team these days, I tell people that I'm always talking to, it's like, you want to be known as confident, and some people will misread it as arrogant, and I'm sure I get misread as arrogant quite a bit because I'll stand up with a smile face and go, here we go, let's do it. And they're like, an arrogant prick. And it's like, well, no, if you want to tell me something, I'll sit there and listen. And that's the difference. And be confident all your life. Don't be arrogant.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
just one quick one. How many times did you watch Top Gun?
Oh, I've never seen it.
Folks. How about the pause?
Yeah. Yeah, I might have watched it a few times. I can probably quote a reasonable amount of it. See, Tom Cruise wants to be me. Yeah.
That's awesome. It's
that was a pretty funny pregnant pause there, as you guys are like.
Well, I surely watched it. Because just earlier today, we spoke to a Navy SEAL, and Matt asked the sort of the same question. How many times you watched, what is it, Navy SEALs?
Yeah.
With Charlie Sheen. And he just goes, yeah, heaps, mate, heaps. He makes his son watch it. He makes his daughter watch it, you know. This bloke's
the problem's coming now. Like, I got young staff that work for me, and I'll throw like lines from Top Gun.
They wouldn't have a clue.
Kim's there going,
naughty.
The girls in the office will be like, yeah, right,
that about?
Yeah, exactly.
did you have like a call sign?
No.
Bullshit.
What did you call yourself?
I called myself Maddie. Well, everyone called me Maddie. I had a few, like In the US, they're big into call signs.
Yeah,
in Australia, they're not as much. I was called Raz for a while, which was requires adult supervision because I was so young.
That's a mad note.
And I looked, I looked like I was 13 when I was also like,
yeah, really?
I was skinny and just baby faced. So everywhere we went, it's like, yeah, I'm a fighter pilot. And everyone was like, yeah, bullshit, you are. And I'd go into a nightclub and they wouldn't let me in and things like that. So I'd actually go wild and crazy and be kicked out. Of probably your security company was half of my problem. Then it became with all the squadron guys, it's like, where's Raz? You know, he requires help supervision no matter where he's going.
That's
like,
awesome, though.
Yeah, so I'd go out there and I'd lead, you know, I was a Top Gun instructor. I'd lead 8-ship war missions, but I was required help supervision in the nightclub.
That's insane. you're so young, you know, in control of such a machine. And
yeah.
So getting into the, you know, the flying of the F-18, you end up going to the US as well, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. So basically straight out of the my Top Gun school, I stayed there as an instructor at our Top Gun school. And then you start complacency starts to kick in, actually, and that's where, once again, Defence Forces, it's just such an amazing establishment for people's well-being generally, you know, most of the time, because they know that, you know, complacency is dangerous. You know, when you're doing war fighting type events,
yeah,
complacency gets you and your mates killed. But it's a very hard thing to battle, because even, you know, people with the best intention in the world can become complacent when it starts to be repetitive. And that's what started happening to me. I started realizing I was becoming a little bit complacent flying F-18s. You know, I'd go to work going, just got to go for another F-18 flight today. How boring.
Yeah.
And that starts to get dangerous. And so what the Defence Force is generally good at is always giving people a new challenge.
Something new.
A new posting, a new event. But when you're a Top Gun instructor on Hornets, you go, well, where's the next challenge?
100%.
If I just plateaued, you know, I was 26, 27 years old and I'm a Top Gun instructor going, well, where to from here? You know, is it downhill from here?
Yeah.
It's like, that's pretty depressing at that age. So what the Air Force does is then they'll always come up with something bigger and better. And what they did for me is they sent me on an exchange program to the United States Air Force, flying F-15E Strike Eagles, which is, you know, I still believe is probably one of the best aircraft, best combat weapons in the world. So, quite an amazing experience to go over there and fly that aircraft for someone else's Air Force. Yeah,
was it much of a transition from the F-18 to that? Jet?
It was. It was about an 8-month course, actually. So I had to do a full course on it with baby students, like guys that never flown.
Oh, really?
So it was easier for me because I knew the tactics. I knew how to do everything. In fact, you know, they actually accelerated me through parts of it. And then I instructed instructors, because that was my job as a Top Gun. So while I was on course, I was actually instructing the instructors on how to do air-to-air maneuvering, because that was my specialty back here in Australia. And so I got accelerated through, but it still took quite a while because it's a two-seat aircraft. So you've got, you know, Hornet single seat. You had to learn crew resource management. You had to learn how to work with a guy directly in your back seat and be efficient with them, rather than being the control freak type A personality that most fighter pilots are. You had to actually share the toys, like, you know, like, give it to me, I've got it. And the F-15, you know, it's a – it's a different systems, you know, so you had to go and learn how all the systems work in case something goes wrong. So it was a long course, but once again, I enjoyed the hell of it because I'm living in another country, getting paid to be there and flying a new aircraft and making new friends. And, you know, on that side of things as well, once again, the military, it doesn't matter where you go in the world, you meet someone in the military, speak the same language, different country.
Exactly.
Different role, different service,
you just gel together.
And you like us sitting here right now, it's like we've known each other all our lives.
Yeah.
So it was just an amazing experience to go and meet new friends who you felt you've known forever.
Yeah. Can we just touch on Top Gun training? Yeah. Oh, what is it here in Australia, sorry? What are they called?
Fighter combat instructor.
What does that involve? Like the training time, like the actual, like the, what is it? Just the whole thing.
Yeah. So there's basically three phases to it. And so it's a 6-month course, or 5 months, you know, when you take out a little bit of you know, it starts mid-January, finishes mid-June typically, and the objective is to become the most proficient pilot you can be on that aircraft. So it's not like get good at it, it's like know the aircraft inside out, every capability, look at new capabilities that are coming and how to integrate them into the aircraft efficiently, be able to work with politicians about doctrine, and you know, if we go to war, we're going to be the guys the the PM comes to and says, "Righto, Matt, what do you think we should be doing with the fighters in this situation? We are, you know, the cream of the crop on that side of things."
Right, okay.
And the three phases are basically you learn – initially we have to become instructors because we've got to be able to teach our skills. So the first 4 or 5 weeks is instructor course, basically a really quick run of being instructor. Then we do an air-to-air phase for about 2 months, which culminates in a massive air defense exercise where we defend a base, typically Williamtown, and then – you know, back then F-111s and Navy ships and everything would be trying to attack our base, and we had to defend it. We had to do harpoon attacks against the Navy, and we had to, you know, defend against the F-111s that coming in, and all the other Hornet squadrons around Australia would come down and try and attack, and we just had to beat them off with a stick. And then the last phase is air to ground, like attack phase.
Yeah.
So that's the offensive side of it. And then that's where we'd typically go up to Tyndall and would operate in the Northern Territory, supersonic overland. And you know, they'd bring in all the American units as well. So we'd be fighting F-15s, F-16s, B-52s, and it'd be a massive exercise called
Aces
North.
That's so
cool. And they'd bring the Army in, and the Army would be doing ground ops while we're trying to manage, you know, close air support with people getting overrun and trying to do extractions of downed air crew and everything you can think of as you're doing a fighter. We were the ones running it, and yeah, it's still Australia's most expensive exercise that runs every couple of years.
Yeah. The thing of all the other exercises, we got Talisman Sabre, which is an absolute huge one.
Shit, I've spent a lot of time.
Oh, same. So what's the Hamill? Is the other one?
Yeah,
yep. Hamill.
Yeah,
and then you got Pitch Black. Yeah. So those exercises and Aces North trumps them all for the amount of ordnance that go downrange and
really?
The amount of assets that come in. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It's huge, and it's typically for six graduates are the ones that are getting the benefit from it.
Wow.
Yeah, and so that's where the, you know, the investment the military puts in you, and if you add up the numbers on that, that you know, you run an exercise like that for 4 weeks with international support for six graduates, you go, they've put $1 billion into me now, so
easy,
just a little bit, just a little bit of money,
isn't it? Like I don't think civilians understand how much money just gets pumped into, obviously, you know, day to day life, even in like Defence Force, you know. You might look at something and go, "Oh, stuff it," you know. It's like taxpayers' money's paying for it, and it's just like whatever. And we see, like, you go drop bombs, you shoot bullets, you go burn a fuel, it'd be jet fuel or diesel for tanks or diesel for the ships, you know. You never realise how much money just gets actually spent through defence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just the pilot himself.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Missiles, you know, Hornet missiles, you know, $2 million a shot. You know, I've probably shot 10 or 15 of them over my career.
So, yeah. Holy Christ.
Yeah, so like, oh, there goes another $2 million.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that amazing?
I led a mission where there was four of us, and we shot two missiles each simultaneously. So we launched 8 missiles simultaneously at a towed target. And so there goes $16 million in 2 seconds.
Isn't that wild? Yeah. So I think in the Navy, we don't actually own our missiles. I don't know the actual name, but the ones on the frigates, the vertical launch system.
Yep.
I don't think we own it. We actually rent them out. And then if we do shoot them, we've got to pay them to the US.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that's how it works. It's not the same with our Air Force?
No, the Air Force maintains their own stockpiles. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We do have stockpiles down at Eden.
Yeah.
We go there to pick up like bombs, bullets, that sort of jazz.
Yeah.
But from my understanding, yeah, that expensive, and we don't ever use them.
Yeah. The problem is, you know, we keep war stocks, but they do time expire.
Yeah.
Hence why that particular mission I talked about, we had four aircraft pickle off 2 missiles each into the ionosphere. That was because that time expired. It's like, you gotta
get rid of it. Yeah.
Use them or lose them. So we can either put them in a dump and blow them up, or we can go shoot them.
We've done it in Afghanistan. Yeah. Just all our ammunition, and there'll be rocket launchers and grenades. Just put one big giant pile and claim all. And just blow it all up in one, because you got to get rid of it. Yeah,
I've seen one of those explosions with the shockwave coming off when you do an ordnance clearing.
In the Navy, we're not that cool. We just like we got that much crap. Yeah, we do. We just like I remember coming home from the Gulf, and like you got that much just like bombs and bullets and shit. You can't be bothered shooting them, and we literally just cracked the lids off the tins straight over the side. And I don't bloody care. I'm bloody saying it now. And the amount of bullets were thrown over the side, it was just ridiculous. Like, I'm talking hundreds, if not thousands of rounds, like 50 cal, 5.56, shotgun.
Yeah. Now you're out. You think of it.
I can say whatever I want.
And you go, oh, man, I should have just loaded up a gun and gone for it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Time you're like, you know what? I'm just tired. Just throw it overboard.
Well, exactly.
We're shooters, you know, in the civilian side of, you know, and a round now costs us like $1 a round to buy from the shop.
I'm like, 2 to 3. Yeah, like, well, man, I should have put it in my pocket.
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally get it.
Yeah, right. So let's talk about deployments.
Yep.
You went to the Middle East.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So that was a weird one, actually. So, I was I just finished my F-15 training at the end of – so basically I was told I was going to America on exchange in the middle of 2001. It's like, hey, dude, in December this year, you're going to be heading overseas for 3 years. I'm like, sweet, here I go. And then September 2001, the World Trade Center gets hit.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, jeez. Yeah, and that was a – yeah, I think every military person or every military type personality looked at that and went, that's a game changer.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know what that means to me personally. It's going to have an effect on me. I don't know where and how, but that's going to affect my life quite significantly. And so I still went to America in December of 2001, but I got there and America was like, yeah, on war footing. Yeah, they're like, man,
yeah,
what's going on? Yeah, but the squadron I turned up in were doing 24/7 cap overhead Washington with loaded jets to take down airliners.
That's
like,
crazy.
So I turn up to a squadron and they're capping 24/7 overhead Washington. I'm like,
yeah, right.
Wow, I never ever thought I'd see this in my life. And everyone's run down and drained because they've been doing it for 3 months at that point. But it's like that's a big commitment for these guys to be 24/7. So I did my conversion and finished that towards the back end of 2002, started doing some training, and then my boss called me into the office and goes, "Hey, Matt, we're going to have to stand you down for a while because we're being deployed, and we haven't got enough jets to keep you flying because we've got to do workup training for deploying, and yeah, you know, you're Australian, you can't come." It's like it sucked actually because I don't think people join the military because they want to go and kill people. People join the military because they want to protect their what they think are the correct moral standards of the world.
100%.
So when your squadron is told they're going somewhere, you're not sticking your hand up because you want to go blow people up. You're sticking your hand up because your buddies are going to go do something that you truly believe in and you want to be there to watch their back. And it's like, you know, I try and explain it to civilians and I say, it's like lining up for a grand final. You know that there's a good chance you're going to break an arm or come out with a bloody nose. Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't fucking say no because you've got to be on there when your mate's getting piled on. You want to be on there to take the other guy out.
Exactly.
And you don't care if it's going to hurt you.
Well
said.
You
just want to make sure that your buddies are good and keeps doing his job. And that's why you want to go. And so when I was told that I couldn't go, it was devastating to me. I was like, yeah, I have to be there. I've trained all this time in my career. I've been in for a bit, about 11 years. So I'd put my heart and soul into being the best I can be, not so I can go and survive, not so I can go and kill people. It's so that when I'm called upon, I can stand there shoulder to shoulder with my brothers in arms and do what's morally right. Yeah. And to not have that opportunity was devastating.
Whereabouts were you based when you were back overseas?
I was based in North Carolina, Seymour Johnson. Yeah, okay. Believe it, Seymour Johnson. No kidding. That was the name of the base. It's like, I thought it was a joke when they said, "You're going to be posted to Seymour Johnson." I'm like, come on, guys, really?
It was a piss take.
But no kidding, it's called Seymour Johnson. I'm like, I'm not going to be telling 10 people at Morissette that one.
So after you got told the news you're not going to be flying, did you get sent straight back home?
No, I actually volunteered to come home. So I'm like, well, if I'm not going to be flying here, I want to at least come home and try and do something.
Yeah, gotcha.
So if I can come back and get straight back on a Hornet and do something worthwhile, because I felt useless. And then it was a couple of days later, I was called back into the boss's office and he said, it was a couple of days after the squadron left and one of the bosses called me in and said, "Hey, Matt, we didn't want to tell you this because we didn't know if it was going to work or not, but we've been working at pretty high levels, basically, ministerial level, PM versus Secretary of State level, saying, we've got this Aussie, he's good, he's got the wrong rank on his shoulder, but we want him." And it was signed off. And,
So
I was actually chucked on an airliner and flew into the Middle East on an airliner with all my kit.
Yeah.
got arrested as I rolled into – I was going to Qatar and I got arrested there on arrival because I was carrying – all this military equipment. And then released and then allowed to go to my base at Qatar and join my squadron. And then did 2 days of briefings of like, this is what you need to know. Because they'd done like a 2 month workup.
Yeah, yeah.
And now I'm turning up with 2 days.
You're one of those ones.
Yep. I turn up and they're like, fire hose me with information. I did one local area flight just to have a quick run around in an F-15 around the local area just so I knew how to get in and out of our base without getting shot down because we had a lot of air defense around our own base to stop attacks. And then you went and did shock and awe. So rolled up.
Yeah, right.
Climbed in an F-15 and did a strike into downtown Baghdad as my
Holy
first,
shit.
My
did
first
you?
Mission. Yeah.
What year was this?
This was March 2002. No, sorry, 2003.
Were you there?
No.
Yeah, so 2003. Yeah, so yeah, well, there was an Australian ship in the Gulf. So we were out of Qatar, would run up the North Arabian Gulf, head over, head Kuwait, and then fence in, push yep. in, and first mission was turn left just before Kuwait into Saudi and tank. So the tankers were sitting in Saudi, not in Iraqi airspace because of threats there. And then it was like, come off the tanker as the sun's just about to come up and poof, off we go into Baghdad. Get shot at and drop bombs. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
right.
Actually, I actually saw the war start because, the Shock and Awe mission, which most people have heard of the Shock and Awe mission.
Yeah.
That was the start of the war.
Right.
And I was in the second wave, which was, call it maybe 20 minutes behind the first wave.
Yeah.
I'm running in and I can watch the first wave in front of me on my link display. See all the friendlies and everything, they're all converging from different angles onto Baghdad.
Wow.
And watching all the, it was absolutely amazing. I'm sitting there, it's calm out, no one's talking. I'm sitting there in my F-15, like sun's coming up, I'm heading north. I got my wingman sitting a mile away on my wing. Watching my link display, see all these fighters and bombers closing in, and then start seeing all these lock lines. So we get lines that appear, yep. which show that they're designating their targets. So everyone can see which targets being designated. Yeah. All the lock lines start appearing. I'm going, man, they've designated. Yeah, they're designated. And then the lock lines start flashing. That means weapons release.
Oh, shit.
So you're just going, holy shit, the war, there's no taking that back. It's like you just said, fuck to mum. That's it. It's on. Yeah, you can't take it back. And there's weapons in flight. And I look out the front and it's still dark and you can see the glow of Baghdad and all the lights and everything. And just going, there's weapons in the air. And then it just starts like, just little pin, like bumped, you're in your airborne. You don't see this, just like, just little flashes of light.
And your thoughts on that, were you just like, this is what I trained for? Were you excited? Were you nervous? Or were you just like, this is fucking sick?
I was just focused. It was like, okay, my next move. So as soon as I started seeing that, it actually just training kicked in. First thing I started doing was just maneuvering my aircraft, just slight changes in heading because you've just stirred up the ant's nest.
Yeah.
And they're not going to lie down taking this, So, within 30 seconds, AAA missiles coming up. And one of my first thoughts was, well, at least the first wave got in unnoticed. Now they're angry.
Yeah.
Now they're angry. And so you're going in, going, right. The night before I did the mission, my squadron boss, he was looking after me pretty well actually, because he's like, I was the fish out of water, and he drove me back to my tent, staying in tents, and he said, hey Matt, it's going to be a big one tomorrow. Chances are we're going to lose a jet. Someone's probably going to bag a MiG.
Jesus.
He goes, don't be a hero. Come home. Like,
we're going to bag a MiG.
Yeah, yeah.
Imagine hearing that. We're going to bag a MiG.
And then he goes, right, have a good sleep.
All right, cool.
Yeah. So, I'm sitting there going, man, like, here we go. Training's kicked in. I'm jinking and jiving. And said that the thought I'd had the night before was from Gulf War One back in 91.
Yeah.
So I'd just joined the Air Force and we'd all be sitting in the officer's mess. I'm an officer cadet and you're watching the guys holding up a sign saying, I'm a prisoner of war, and they've got black eyes and they've been getting the shit beaten out of them. And then on TV is propaganda. I'm like, don't let me be that guy. I don't want to be, on TV.
Al Jazeera.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm gonna fight tooth and nail all the way out. I'm gonna ride the jet in. So you're just thinking, don't get shot.
Yeah,
don't get shot.
This whole time, Matt, did you have any contact with like the RAF the whole time? Were they like, Matt, is it all sweet over there, buddy? You're like, yeah, man, I'm having a great time, mum.
The funny thing is, no kidding, it's absolutely out of this world. So we deployed a fighter squadron to the Gulf. We deployed six F-18s. So it was a small deployment, but six F-18s and a squadron, a combined squadron. So they built up a squadron and sent them over there. So I rock up on my airline, get picked up, rested, boom. They drive me onto the base, and then they drop me off at a tent. They were big combined tents, air-conditioned tents where the squadrons slept in the tent.
Yeah.
So I go, here's your tent. And it's like the F-15 tent with an American flag flying. And I look at the tent next door, and it's got an Aussie flag flying and a magpie on it for 75 squad. And I'm like, you got to be fucking shitting me. My neighbours.
Cool.
Yeah, so I go in there. I had a little torch. I go into the tent. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I get the torch out. I'm like, oh, there's Puds. There's Fieldridge. And I'm walking through and, like, just waking them all up. They're like, holy shit, what are you doing here? I'm just in a pair of jeans and a T-shirt walking into their tent in the middle of a war. Like, what the fuck? So, yeah, it was pretty amazing, actually. So we ended up, you know, I'd spent a lot of time catching up with my mates and in fact, helping them when I could as well, because, you know, we carried a lot of weapons and, you know, we did a lot of stuff downtown, whereas the Hornets were – initially weren't allowed into Baghdad because of the threat against it, whereas the Americans are like, yeah, we're prepared to lose jets. Australians are like, we will not lose jets. We'll do our work, but we cannot afford to lose a jet in combat.
Yeah.
So whereas the Americans are like, we can lose jets. We're going in there to wreak havoc.
So
we went in downtown, you know, on that first mission, shock and awe. I got shot at, you know, missiles, AAA, everything's just going off around me, and the Australians were holding back. But I was getting past targets quite often, or we were finding targets. So if I was, say, coming home with no weapons left and there was a Hornet coming out the other way, one of my mates, I'd be like, hey, go secure. We get on crypto and it's like, hey, there's three tanks hanging out on the road at this location.
Oh, yeah.
Go kill
Pass it on.
Go kill those tanks. And they're like, woo.
Yeah, right.
That is cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's just how the military work, you know.
Like, when you're under the control of the US Air Force, was it like open slather? Like any like targets, like a target? Like did you have open rain?
Yeah, so it varied on the mission we're on. So shock and awe was pre-planned targets. So, my target actually, and it's pretty sad, was the barracks of the Republican Guard. So it was a dawn strike and was take out their barracks.
Wow.
That's a pretty big mission, you know.
Yeah.
That haunts you at a later life when you're like, yeah, they were just doing their job, sleeping in the morning, and I took
still sleeping now.
Yeah, exactly. I took the buildings out, and so that was pre-planned. That was
it's wild, isn't
it? Yeah. But there were other times it was like, basically free reign. Here's your kill box. You'd get allocated a box and go find targets, you'd find targets. You'd if you're shot at, you're cleared to engage straight away. Or if you found targets, you then had to get confirmation that it's a valid target through Jace, like talking to the 747 that was hanging down in Saudi, who would talk to Florida, who would then confirm. You know, like a 2 minute story. Like, so this is 2003. You know, so this is, you know, mobile phones weren't happening.
Yeah.
Internet wasn't really. Yeah,
it was shit.
It was.
Yeah, it was.
So I'm sitting in a cap at nighttime, and I'm looking at a target. We've got targeting pod and everything. I've got night vision goggles on. I'm looking at night vision goggles and the targeting pod going, I'm pretty sure that's a tank that's hiding down there. And they're like, yeah. And so I'm talking to a 747 that's in Saudi. I go, yeah, I think I got a target. I think it's a tank. And he's like, yeah, stand by. We're sending a Predator in. So they go, what's your height? I'm at like 20,000. No descent below 18,000. Predator's coming in at 15 to have a look with you. So I'm like, okay, can't see him. And, you know, it's nighttime. And then so I'm loitering for another 10 minutes. And he says, so the J-Star goes, I just got an email from the Predator. You're cleared to engage. And now this is, so I'm sitting in an F-15 in 2003. Talking to a 747 in Saudi Arabia who just got an email from someone in Florida who's steering the Predator that says they've looked at it with their pods and they've cleared me to engage. It's like, it's just not what you're expecting to hear.
That's back incredible. In that
day.
In
this day and age, yeah, for sure. But it's like, I just got an email from the Predator, you're cleared to engage.
You're good to go.
Okay.
That's insane. Like,
that is cool.
Yeah. Wild. I spent a couple of years in Baghdad.
Yeah.
Only a couple of years ago.
Okay.
I was doing private security.
Yeah.
So it still has the remnants of that invasion.
Yeah.
There's literally buildings that are just cordoned off still, and they've just got big holes in them.
I have no doubt. Yeah. We put a lot of, hardware into that city.
Yeah.
Especially mainly that night, actually. We did a lot. We put, the shock and awe was like, you know, the first part of the mission was hit them so just hard, they just roll over.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, we give up straight away.
Yeah.
And it nearly worked, you know, because they didn't launch a single fighter. No. Yeah. We were thinking we were going to get back at MiG. They didn't, the first Gulf War, they were launching MiGs every day and were shooting down MiGs.
Yeah.
They actually dug holes and buried their aircraft. Did they really? To hide them from us.
Yeah, right.
So that we didn't destroy them. So they didn't even plan to get airborne because – and then when we hit them, they were like, yep, we're not going to –
we're not going
to
think about
We're not even going to think about getting up there with those guys.
Man.
So it nearly worked, but then they got a little bit of resistance down and down the southeast and against the Marines, and then that boosted their spirits, and then it just turned into a – you know, the air war only lasted 6 weeks. You know, I was only in theatre for 6 weeks and caught the airline back.
What is it? Yeah. And,
because there was no more bombing. We cleaned up everything we could, and then after that it was a ground war with just minimum, still air support.
Yeah.
But the full heavy bombing situation was no longer needed.
Yeah, right.
Can we just go back onto flying in the combat zone? So when you get locked on by a missile – obviously, you guys know that.
Yeah.
Obviously. How does that how does it talk to your jet to say, hey, we've got a missile coming in, Matt, and then you go, sweet, your pucker valve starts going. And,
Yeah. It depends on the type of missile. So a heat seeker, you won't know because it's got – so it's a passive system. It does, a heat-seeking missile doesn't transmit anything. So there's no way your aircraft knows that it's being targeted. But heat-seeking missiles, SAMs, they're shot – typically from from the ground level with low altitude capability. So if you stay above 10,000 feet, they can't lock you and they can't shoot.
Right,
so we'd set a floor of 10,000 feet so you wouldn't be targeted by them. It's the radar guided missiles that have the longer shot you have to worry about because they can go to 50,000 feet, and they can go 30 miles. So they're the ones you have to be aware of. And what happens there is, they're using a radar on the ground to light you up, and our aircraft have receivers that can see the type of radar, the frequency it's using, the bandwidth it's using, and right, that is one of these. And then it's displayed in our aircraft as you are being looked at by a search system for an SA-2.
Hectic.
And then it'll go, right, you've been locked up by the SA-2. So they've now chosen you. So it'd be like, you've been sweeping, bip, bip, bip. They're looking at you, boom, they've chosen you. And now you start trying to deny launch. So you start maneuvering so that they can't get a weapon solution on you because they've got to line all the dots up and go, right, send the missile in that direction. But then the missile, if they launch the missile, then you get another type of signal that you receive, which is missile guidance, because they've got to talk to the missile to guide the missile.
Okay.
So you'll actually receive the same information the missile's getting because they're transmitting in line with the missile and you. So you get that guidance command into your aircraft. So your aircraft goes, guidance signals, there's a missile in flight. And you're the birthday boy. Well done. You better start trying to survive.
Yeah.
And so you then that's when you go, right, it's that's now no mental. Shit, live. So it's like a term we use is when you're going in, you're going in on government time. When you're targeted or you're going out on your own time.
Yeah.
So it's like do what you have to do now. You're no longer caring about dropping bombs. Your first priority is
evade,
survive, keep the jet alive and bring it home.
Yeah.
So, and no, I had, I started to lose count after a while, but I think it was about,
oh, shit.
I think it was about four or five missiles that engaged me. There was one in particular that was missed.
Close?
Oh, yeah. It was like, I'm going to die in half a second. I didn't die. I guess it missed. It was last ditch defense, like high G barrel roll with chaff and flares coming out as it went past me. It's like, and then, that was the only time I actually got any sort of, adrenaline while doing it.
Yeah.
Cause it's just, it's military that, it's when you get into you're going to die. So when you're doing what you're doing, and even if you're shooting people, it's so focused and so disciplined that there's no adrenaline. It's like, this is my job. And it's
exactly.
Boom, boom. Okay.
Yeah.
This is the first step. Warning. Okay. Warning shot. Okay. Drop it. Okay. Keep going. And same whether you're on the ground or in a fighter, it's all the same stuff. But when you go, okay, they've got the upper hand and I'm now trying to live, that's when adrenaline kicks in. And that was the only, I did get shot at a lot. I didn't get adrenaline on the other shots because I was like, okay, I can see I'm being shot at and I've got 10 seconds to solve this and I can. Whereas this particular one, it's like, okay, I'm getting shot at, got 10 seconds to solve it. Okay, I've got 5 seconds to solve it. Holy shit, we're down to the last second and I haven't solved it yet. And it was like just everything at it and came out and then all of a sudden I just started shaking shit. And it's like, felt sick in the stomach. And keep going. You can't just pull over and have a spew. It's like, where's the next missile? Where's the follow-up?
Yeah.
And keep fighting, get out. And the only time I've ever been scared in an aircraft was about 20 minutes later. It was because I went over, well, that was on the ingress to the target area. We did dropped our bombs. I was coming back out and we're min fuel. And it's like, I've got to go back over the site. And all I could think about was, it's like a horror movie. You're like, don't go back in the room.
Oh,
you know,
shit.
You think you've just killed someone and they're dead. And, you know, like you're watching a movie and everyone's just ignoring the supposedly dead person. You're like, get out of there. Get out of there. He's going to get you. I was going, this is a fucking horror movie. They're going to go, why did he go back over it after he survived the first one? Then it killed him the second time.
Yeah.
And I'm playing this scenario in my head. And I was actually scared. I'm like, this is the day I'm going to die. And I had no other option. I had to go over it. It didn't shoot at me, and I made it home, obviously. But it was like, this is the day I'm going to die, and I convinced myself of it while I was flying towards it.
That's hectic.
That whole time, your wingman is with you, correct?
Yep.
What is he doing? Is he just like, see ya? Is he peeling off, or is he trying to?
He's doing the same thing.
Is he get locked on as well?
No. So he wasn't locked on, and he plays a supporting role. So he's basically, trying to make sure he's not getting shot at and making sure I haven't got any follow-up shots coming on me and then calling me out of the fight, because when you're fighting to survival, you basically – you fill your whole brain with survival so that as soon as you've survived, you're like, where am I? Mm. Which way should I go now to survive the next shot? So, basically it was like, missile shot, defending, and then come out, overshoot, and then it'd be like, Matt, come out north, roll out there. Gate, you light the burners, let's go, and brings me out of the fight, because I'm basically like a baby at that stage, I am alive and I've got the weapon. I've got the weapon system with me. My back seat is alive. Someone tell me where to go. And that's the supporting role. And it'd be same in every sort of service around the world. You get one guy that's in a scrap, and the team then comes around, go, you good? Yep. Right. Come with me and pick him up by the scruff of the neck and run. It's like, he's just survived. And then drag him.
Wow, that's 6 weeks. Like, that 6 weeks, probably most hectic 6 weeks of your life.
How many? How many bombs did you drop all up? You reckon?
I used to know that as well, but it was somewhere around. Yeah, I'd like to say it was less than 100, but it was. Yeah, it was up there. Yeah, it was up there. Yeah, for a while there, I think they overtook me in the end, but I dropped more bombs personally than the Royal Australian Air Force.
Shit.
So the Hornets were there, they had six jets and they were rotating.
Yeah.
But the Hornet was only carrying, two bombs per load, whereas I was carrying 13. And so, I'd go out every night with 13 bombs and just clean the jet off and go back out again the next night. Yeah, some nights I went out twice. There's one particular mission. I actually got medals, American medals for it, for heroism under fire, because I ended up going back into the fight. We ran out of bombs, and there were some Marines on the ground getting overrun. Mm. And the guy was almost crying on the radio. He was like, "We need support. We're taking losses." And I had a four ship. I was in there supporting them. It took a while to figure out the battle. Because it's close air support, so you got to figure out who's who, because you don't want to be putting bombs in the wrong spot. And they're calling danger close, which means you're putting bombs inside the normal template, because they're like, I don't care if we get hit with these bombs, we've got to stop these guys because we are going to all die unless you stop them. So we softened them, but we ran out of weapons. And he's like, you got to get more assets in here. And so I was talking to the 747 down the road, and he's like, but there's nothing left. So then I'm like, sorry guys, I've got to go. We're out. And he's like, send something in. And I'm like, I'll do my best. It's the middle of the night, rock up. I'm heading down the North Arabian Gulf, and I'm talking to my own ops desk, going, have we got any jets? And they're like, yeah, we've got two jets, no crews. Yeah, everyone's on crew rest. I'm like, are they good? And they're like, yep, I'm taking them. So
that's hectic.
Went down, we landed. I kissed off my number 3 and 4. It's like, see you later, go to bed. Grabbed my wingman, and we just pre-flighted the jets, got back in. We launched, and then just basically supersonic up the North Arabian Gulf. And because I knew the battlefield, I pitched up again.
Yeah.
Just went straight to frequency and like, hey, mate, you there? You're like, yeah, he's there. And you're like, fuck, that's first thing, he's still there. He recognized my voice. I'm the only Aussie flying an American jet. And I'm like, okay, mate, just give me a quick sit-rev update. He's like, same situation, same lines, still taking losses. I'm like, right, in live. And just within, the first time it took an hour to get rid of 4 aircraft worth of bombs. The second sortie took 5 minutes to clean the jets off. Like, we know the situation.
Just dumped it.
Cleaned it up, and then came off and got, we're Winchester again. He's like, dude, no movement. It's like, sweet, job done. You go home, you're like, that's a big day.
Oh,
and you fly home going, I did something worthwhile. Like saying at the start of this thing, you go out there, you stand shoulder to shoulder.
Yeah.
I wasn't winning a war that night, but I was saving their lives.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's the bit, yeah.
That's hectic.
With when you I don't know how to put the words. When you're flying your like your first jet and you're out of bombs and you're like, yeah, sweet, we'll go back, we'll drop this one off, go get another jet. What was like the turnaround time? Like 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 5 minutes?
We were on the concrete, like with our feet, I'd say for probably 2.5, 3 minutes.
Wow.
And I was airborne just probably 6 minutes later.
And how long does a usually pre-flight check take? To like
45 minutes.
Fuck me.
So it was like rules were out. It's like, yeah, I'm just, like, just get in.
Just
and,
jump in.
And we cranked up, taxied on one engine, like starting the second engine while taxiing. It's like, yeah, rolling, yeah, onto the runway, like burners are lit. It's like, let's just go. It's,
what was the air control doing? Yeah. It was just like, yeah, you boys go,
It was like, because I told ops I'm doing it. Fuck. And then ops then greased the wheels. They're like, prep the jets, make sure there's, you know, just get them pre-flight. Because normally there's panels open. You go and check every single bomb is all correct and wired correctly. Yeah. And, you know, every single panel is closed. And it's like, oh, dudes, I don't care. I don't care if a panel comes off airborne. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't matter at the moment. Yeah. I don't care if one of the bombs duds. It doesn't matter. I've just got to get what I can back on site right now. And it's the American, you know, they leant forward and the red tape disappeared. And it's like, the jets are ready. And you're cleared for takeoff.
If that was the Australian Air Force, oh, you can't do that. Yeah, Matt. You know, exactly.
Yeah,
you know the Navy's the same. Right?
Yeah,
anyway.
But it was that. That's probably the most special mission I talk about, is because it was
I love that one.
It was pretty amazing because normally you come out in fuel as well, so you tiptoe out of the airspace because you're like, right, we've run out of fuel doing all of our stuff. And that particular one, I had plenty of gas because it was so quick. And it was the only time and you don't want to use afterburner typically in these jets. One, because I use a shitload of fuel, the F-15 in particular, it uses about 200,000 pounds of fuel an hour. So a bit over 100,000 litres an hour going out. It's a 200 litre drum every 6 seconds.
Wow.
Is going out the back. So so you use a lot of fuel. But the second thing is at nighttime you highlight yourself because it's a 100 foot flame out the back.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's massive. It's longer than the jet when you're supersonic. So but I went, you know what, I'm coming out with fuel. I've had a big night, and we've done some stuff.
Put on a show,
and we started gate, and it was just on dawn that like there's just getting a little bit of color in there, and just gate, which is a full burner, pitched the nose up. We went to 50,000 feet and came out at Mach 2 at 50,000 feet, just like supersonic across Iraq. We're here, and don't fuck with us. So it was a bit of a statement, but it was a pretty high five moment to be watching the sun come up supersonic with once again your best mates in the world sitting in jets at 50,000 feet to a Mach 2.
Did you have music playing over there?
I
can almost think about the song.
I requested a flypass when I got back, but the pattern was full, so I couldn't.
Yeah, negative, girls.
With the imagine the troops on the ground just slight. They obviously wouldn't have seen it coming because they would have been asleep all night. But when it passed, they would have been like, "Holy fuck!" You know what Americans like? They would have just been getting blooded up.
Exactly, and they'd be like, "That's our boys." Yeah.
And then the Iraqis would have been like, "Oh fuck! What the hell was that?"
Yeah, exactly. And they're like, "Well." Well, they don't even care anymore. They're going supersonic and burner, and they're not scared at all. And the guys that I've just the guys that we've just helped, you know, they'd be seeing us disappear as two after burning, like see your boys and off you go. And so it's, you know, as I say, you don't join the military to kill people. You join the military to do what you believe is the right thing and support your mates. And that ticked all those boxes that night. Exactly. That's for sure.
Yeah. Right. Well, let's talk about your transition into, you know, Red Bull. And, you know, and you like,
who would have thought, huh?
Yeah, you know, at what stage do you go, all right, I'm dropping bombs in Baghdad, I want to go race the, you know, race planes?
It was a funny one because, it's not something you plan to do.
Racing planes is the only thing.
It's like, how do you start it as well? Like, how did you get into it?
Yeah, so what happens, because I came out of doing the combat ops, came back to Australia, flying F-18s again. And had that little bit of, deja vu. It's like, here I am flying F-18s again back in Australia. Yeah. It's like, if I peaked, you know, is it on the slippery slope down the hill? Is this where I get a beer gut? am I about to have a midlife crisis? So all those things start running through your head. And I thought, I need to I need to do something to challenge myself. So I started doing competition aerobatics. You know, I bought an aerobatic plane, started flying on weekends to, you know, to test myself on the civilian thing. I'd put myself to the ultimate test in the military, passed with flying colours, and now it's like, well, what do I do? What can I do in the civilian world? And so aerobatics, I went and watched a Red Bull air race. Those guys talked to me and said, hey, you're a military guy. You've got combat experience, so we know you work under pressure and you fly these planes on the weekend. You should have a look at this gig. And it just sort of went from there.
Yeah, right. And then so you basically just jumped in.
How did you get picked up to start?
Like, how
did you start?
Like,
Because obviously with like a footy team, you go play a game and you get like the scouts and they go, yeah, Shane, Matt.
Do they just see you flying over Lake Mac and just like,
oh, no, you went to Perth, did you? Because so
I went
in Perth.
Yeah, I went to Perth to the race there and just got talking to the locals. And they were the ones, like the guys that were racing, and they're like,
pub owner.
Yeah, no, it was actually one of the race pilots. And he's just like, oh, well, you should have a look at this gig. It's pretty cool. And my first thought was like, no, you guys are crazy. You know, why would I want to do that? You know, I'd rather go to war every day than fly these things. And but then the more I talked to him, the more I realized that it's not as risky as it looks on the outside. It was well planned. It was had a lot of support around it. And the main difference for me was I had a young family then at this stage, and I had a 6-month-old kid. And I realized that if the hordes came over the fence in Australia, I'd be the first person to step up and defend it. But to be sent away to somebody else's war when I've got a 6-month-old kid, I've got more responsibilities now to think about. And while it looks funny, I actually joined the air race because it was a safer career. Yeah, because I get to choose my own risk level. Every day I'm flying, I choose my own risk level. It's whereas every day I'm flying, even in training in the Air Force, it's my wingman who's choosing my risk level. Yeah, you know, I can be as conservative as I want, but my wingman runs into me doing something stupid.
Game over.
Yeah, exactly. So it was one of those things that it was a bit of a lifestyle thing, a bit of a challenge thing, but also a bit of a risk management thing for my future. Sounds weird.
It does.
It's very weird.
So what year did you start competing professionally?
Well, I started training in 2008 and trained all of 2008 with them while I was still in the Air Force as a wing commander, taking long service leave and leave without pay, in fact, to do the training.
Oh, wow.
And then left the Air Force, in fact, on the 17th of January, exactly the same day, 2009. So it was exactly 18 years to the day is when I handed over the keys to the Hornet. And on the exact same day, I happened to be in Salzburg signing a contract with Red Bull. So I didn't even have a single day unemployed at the point.
I went straight into racing. That is crazy.
Yeah. And I often tell people, apart from the guys that walked on the moon, I'm probably the most fortunate fighter pilot to go from something that's a really special career in the military flying fighters to something that's even more
prestige,
special.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas most fighter pilots end up flying and rub a dog shit out of Hong Kong.
my girlfriend loves that film. She loves that quote. She actually was in the RAF as a reservist, so now she's out for Lockheed Martin as a senior engineer. So, okay. She loves you. So.
Sorry.
She loves that quote too.
You can tell her I'm smaller than most people think.
So you almost spent 10 years being a Red Bull air racer.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. I did 8 seasons of racing. They had a couple of years off in the middle there, but raced for 8 seasons, 60 or 70 races all around the world, picked up 30-odd trophies for podiums and 7 race wins. One third place in the world championship, 3 second places, which I thought was a bad trend, and then finally a world championship.
2019.
Yeah, won the
world. I remember listening to Tanya and Steve on the way to work on the week or the day it happened, or just say it was a Sunday, it was like the Monday, and they replayed like your last few seconds, and I think they had you on the radio as well.
Yeah,
and they said something like you'll be forever the world Red Bull Air champion because they've actually stopped it.
Yep.
And I was just like hectic, and here we are 4 years later or so. Years, 3 years later, so.
Yeah. Now I am the forever and a day, the reigning Red Bull Air Race World Champion. The racing looks like it's coming back, but it's not with Red Bull. Yeah. So as far as Red Bull Air Race is concerned, I'm it. Yeah, retirement home, old fart, trying to chat up the nurses. And I'd be like, I'm the reigning world champion, love.
Get how many combat kills I got?
Yeah. They'll think I'm just full of shit if I start telling them what I've done in my life.
Yeah, like, okay, they will.
Sorry, you senile old man. Have your pills.
Why did Red Bull stop and stop the race? For money, or they just didn't get like enough like crowds, or they just couldn't bother with it anymore?
Oh, it was a bit of a plan all along for them. So they were trying to create something special, which they did, and they sold it. Actually, so they shut it down and sold it, and because their business model was never going to be able to last forever, because you know they were they're not an event company; they're a drink company who sponsors things. So here you are having a company that runs a massive event, and you're sponsoring it yourself. It's like
exactly.
So the money was never going to work very well for them, because you know how you can't go right. How do you go and get sponsors, and people go, well, why would we sponsor Red Bull? You know, Red Bull sponsor us. So it made that thing pretty hard. But their objective was to create something and sell it, which they actually did. So unfortunately, there's a company now sitting there on it. They've bought it. They're ready to go, apart from the fact no one can travel. So, I've got a contract to race. I just can't.
Who is that company, mate?
It's a company that no one really knows about, but it's now they've formed a new company called World Championship Air Race. And they've got the pilots already under contract, ready to go.
Wow.
We've got my race planes just out the back here, sitting there. It's not flying at the moment. It's in somewhat of pieces. We're doing little mods on it, just sort of biding our time. I'm staying fit and healthy and training, we're just getting ready. When they pull the trigger, we get back into it.
Yeah, it's funny because we just watched a video of you on, I think it was 2016. You skimmed across the water.
I don't recall that.
Yeah.
pretty sure. Where was it?
It was in Windsor, Detroit.
Yeah,
under Detroit River.
At what stage, you're doing that and you're just like, fuck.
Because obviously you get points for style and speed and like obviously your attitude as well.
No, it's just it's purely time.
Like a track.
Timed race. Yeah. So there's nothing for flair and how low
that
I flew. I won the low flying competition that day.
By about under a foot.
Yeah, exactly. I went sub zero I actually say it was high tide, otherwise I would have missed. it wasn't my proudest day, that's for sure. It was obviously a huge error on my part to get myself into that situation. Some reasonable flying immediately thereafter to get out of it. But you'd always rather not be known for making the error in the first place, that's for sure. So, it was one of those, military kicked in. It was all over in 0.6 of a second, but I can replay that 0.6 of a second and tell the story. It lasts an hour, it's like temporal distortion kicked in. I had absolute awareness of every single piece of equipment around me and what was going on. Everything happened in slow motion.
Yeah.
I was able to, the thoughts that I had, I still go, I watched the video and go, how did I think all of those thoughts in that 0.6 of a second? But, I got it out of the situation, landed it. And then, I had to, not saying that non-military people can't think well, but I think military people are very well trained to analyze and assess, in a debrief and then come up with ways to mitigate the error happening again and do it in a confident, not arrogant way to allow you to keep processing. And that's exactly what we did. A civilian might go throw their hands in the air and go, oh, I'm never doing that again. I quit. Yeah. Or they'll go, geez, I don't know what happened then. But anyway, onwards.
Yeah.
And
oh, well.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, well, don't know what happened then. I nearly killed myself. But anyway, let's go again. I did a full military style debrief with the team and
took
a month to nut every single nut and bolt out and leave no stone unturned. And soul searching and taking responsibility. You can't improve unless you take responsibility for your own errors. And I took responsibility for every single part of that problem. Even though there were problems with the team, I was the team owner. So I took responsibility and solved those problems. And the next time I raced, we got a podium. So it's
What was the actual problem with it? Yes. Judgment, or you just come too fast, or
it was a huge amount of things adding up. Basically, the plane was unsafe, so I was flying an unsafe aircraft, which I knew about. but competition, I was like, oh, I know it's unsafe, but we got to fly because if I pull out, we can't win the championship. So that's straight away. Then you go, there's a mental problem. I'm not valuing my life as opposed to the competition. Yeah. So I've made a mental issue. I was chronically fatigued, you know, from all the travel and all the commitments and sponsor stuff and all that sort of stuff. And then lastly, I was actually had a head cold, and I went and saw the doc, the Red Bull doc. Yeah, it's an Austrian company, and he's he's like, oh, take these tablets. I take these tablets, and I go flying and crash, and I go back to the doctor. I'm in the, you know, getting a medical strap to crash, and he's like, oh, and you're taking any medication? I'm like, only the ones you gave me. He goes, you took them? I'm like, yeah. And he goes, well, you should have taken them. I'm like, dude, you gave them to me. He goes, yeah, but you can't fly on them.
What do you want me to do?
Says, do not operate machinery. It may make you drowsy. Like, dude, what did you think I was going to do? I'm a pilot in the Red Bull Air Race coming to see you because I'm sick. So, yeah, so that was probably a large part of it as well. I was doped up.
That's insane. Do not operate machinery.
That is wild. What was your best race apart from winning that buddy championship? Like, what's the most like funnest tournament? You call it a tournament?
So
Perth is pretty good, is it?
Perth is good, yeah. Perth's a great venue. I'd probably say the most spectacular we do is Budapest, because we go under the under the bridge there to start and stop. Probably the most amazing feeling I've ever had was at Ascot. I won at Ascot. I'm the reigning champion at Ascot well, because I won the last race there. And so Ascot Racecourse in the Queen, you know, where the Queen sits and all that sort of stuff. And we were actually taking off on the royal turf in front of the massive grandstand, 100,000 people grandstand. And you'd take off into the racetrack, and then you'd land after the race and taxi in. And so I won that race, and I'm taxiing in after winning, and then I taxi right up in front of the grandstand. I opened the canopy and stood up, and 100,000 people got on their feet and started cheering.
Yeah,
and I went, I'm a fucking rock star. That's it. Who would have thought a fighter pilot could stand up after a flight? I used to dream of having cheerleaders when you're taxiing in a fighter. This was better.
I wonder if we can organise that.
Yeah, well,
having cheerleaders out the boat flight path.
Yeah, Air Force. You know, we'd have to go on a boat all the time, or we'd have to sleep in tents.
It's funny you say that, because the Navy is. You might have seen on the news a couple of weeks ago. The Navy had that.
Oh yeah, the launch.
They were commissioning that ship or something.
Mate, and, yeah. What a
and
ship
they had
fight
dancers
that was.
There. What was the goal of that?
So my understanding was they were there for a welcome to country. And whoever, I don't know who hires that shit or whatever, but they got the bloke to play the didge, and then along with him, he brought his...
The dancers.
His,
the hip-hop dancers.
The hip-hop dancers. But I don't think the media portrayed it as that all the brass were under the tent, but they weren't there yet.
Yeah.
Not all of them, obviously. What is it? My uncle's the CEO of Cuttable. He's a captain. Yeah. And I saw him in like the video, and I haven't chatted him to it, but I could see his face. And Matthew's like
funny when I was thinking that, because he looked like he's just like, oh my god, and he's not looking at the camera, just looking straight ahead, just going, I think I'm going to hear about this.
Oh, the backlash they caught. But yeah, I remember there's a few boys on that ship that I knew, and I said, what the f was the go with that? They're like, dude, we're on the ship, because like you march on to the ship commission, then the captain of the ship starts us talking, and they all just like, what the fuck is this? Like, are they for real? Like, but you know, if they may have for a commissioning of a ship, you know, which is a huge event, I'm sure they could have everyone on the actual flight path for you guys.
Yeah, some cheerleaders.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I'd take them back if I was going there now. So, you know, it's like the Air Force goes, you should come back and fly. I was like, only if I can bring my cheerleaders.
When World War III kicks off and they pick it back up.
Yeah, I'm a fan of Iron Man, you know. He does it right, you know.
Tony Stark does good. Yeah.
Exactly.
He's
so good. I'm going to go back as Tony.
Yeah, right.
Hey, I've got a quick question for you, Matt. Who would win, a Navy destroyer / frigate or a Hornet in like a fight? Because obviously we're like a sitting duck, you know, the Hornets are pretty agile.
I'd say a Hornet.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I wouldn't come anywhere near you, and I'd just throw a few harpoons downrange.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
we all think that because we're out to sea. Have you ever flown the Hawks or the Jets to witness? And like you can't see, and you guys are obviously smart buggers. You know, you guys fly in like through the sun, you know, and where it's like the ops room's like, they're coming out green 2-0, red 3-0. And you're looking out, there's about six set of eyes looking out. They're all like binos. You're like, we can't see it. They're like, you should be able to see. It's about 7 miles out. oh, here he is, in the gone. It's like,
yeah,
you sneaky dogs, you know?
Yeah.
It's the hardest spot.
When you're like, you, because we'd never get in close to a ship because, you know,
God, no. Got,
yeah, so because you would do fly past, you see the phalanx, you know, tracking us, and you see the sea sparrows moving with us, and you're like, man, they're all over us, and, you know, your roars is lit up, all the stuff that sees all the radars. But I was telling my son last night, actually, at dinner, that I thought I nearly sank an Aussie ship once because I was shooting rockets at a splash target. You know, it's like a, you know, the little float that gets towed on about a 1 mile cord.
Oh, yep.
And so I was shooting rockets and basically I had to pull so much lead. I was focused so much on the target. I was putting a salvo of four rockets onto the target. It was a long range shot. It was 18,000 foot, so about 6 kilometers away when I take the shot. So a long time of flight. So I pull lead, put the pipper on the target, and I pickle, and then the rockets go. And then I was so focused on the target, I didn't realize I was pointing at the ship. So as I pickle, the rockets just go. And then I look, and I go, ooh, I wasn't expecting to go that way because that's where I'm pointing.
Yeah.
I was still just looking at the target. And I look straight out the front, and there's the boat. I'm like, oh my God, I've just sunk an Aussie boat. And then, like, shit. The time of flight's like 30 seconds, and we call them boats, you know, targets. Okay, well. Yeah, targets. Yeah. Okay, floating targets. And it's like, 30 seconds later, it's like time of flight. I hit the target. It's like, oh, there you go. But for that instant there, when I shot the rockets, I'm like,
yeah. Yeah, that could have changed your career.
I might just head east until I flame out. They'll never find me.
You end up in like Suva or somewhere, or Lada, or Chile, but the time.
Yep.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, we've been talking for a good hour and just over an hour, and like, it's been awesome.
This has been fun.
Yeah, yeah. Super fun. And it's one of those things too. Speaking to another veteran as well.
Yeah.
It just again, it's like we've known you for ages.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, exactly.
We haven't really met today.
Yeah.
Like shit.
Absolutely awesome. Otherwise, I've seen you fly over Lake Mac. You know, most weekends and
because
I literally live in Toronto as well, like in one of the apartments right next to the apartment.
There you
go. So every couple of weekends, if I leave, I'll die.
I have escaped.
Yeah, so we see you every you know, when you're flying out over the lake and doing your acrobatic stuff.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, when I left the military, I thought I can live anywhere in the world because I'm in an international business.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I thought, you know what, your home is where, you know, the pubs are.
Yeah,
you know, because that's where your mates.
Exactly.
And I thought, you know, why would you leave this area? You got the lake, you got the Hunter Everything. Valley, you got Port Stephens, and you got the beaches in Merriweather, and you just go, man, it's pretty hard spot to beat in the world.
King Street, Fannies as well.
Yeah. I'm not allowed there. The security company won't let me in.
Mate, come by Wednesday night. We'll be sort of student night.
We'll cut the line clear.
We'll cut.
So generally for our guests, we have two final questions. And the first question is, can you give any advice for anyone, you know, wanting to complete their goals or become a fighter pilot or, you know, become a professional flyer as well.
Or any pilot.
Or any pilot, anything. Just advice in general.
Yeah, I guess the whole thing I push is, you've got to keep revisiting your dream and believe in it, but don't put a timeline on your dream because if you put a timeline on your dream, as soon as you get behind timeline, you give up because you go, oh, I can't make it now.
Yeah.
But your dream should always be active. So your dream should be a big picture on the wall. You see it every day and you go, that's the dream. And then you set goals that are your roadmap to your dream. And your goals, they do have a timeline and they do have specific measurable items. And that might be to pass your aeronautical exam by the end of June. Boom, there's a measurable, achievable goal that you can focus on with a big picture on the wall going, I want to fly an A380 sometime. That's the way to do it. Keep the dream alive without a timeline and set goals with timelines.
Yeah, right.
Happy days. Last one. What is the future for Matt Hall Racing?
Yeah. So obviously you've got
Do you own this building or do you rent it?
I own the airfield. So
oh shit! Okay. Yeah. Fuck. Jesus,
John Travolta.
We're not a pilot now, man. It's John Travolta.
So I don't own it outright. There's a few of us that own it, but I got a few business partners own it. But I'm hoping racing comes back. I want to go out there and defend my title, defend it for Australia, and have a race team indefinitely in the air race.
Yes. Yeah,
so. I want to develop this airfield as it's still a bit run down at the moment. We're slowly doing it up and build this into a really nice corporate style airfield with lots of cool things to do. And I've also got a charter business we're starting up. So Tony Stark style, you know, I've got a plane with a bar in it. No kidding. So I want to be able to take people and they can sit in the plane and drink a champagne while we go on holidays all around Australia and go out to Lord Howe Island for a weekend.
Happy days.
that's and yeah, sharing experiences in aviation is really what it's about for me.
Yeah.
I'm passionate in aviation, and I like helping people. So if I can combine helping people in aviation, the money doesn't really matter in the end. If you're doing what matters, you know, you need enough to survive. But if you're ticking your own moral boxes, it doesn't really matter how much is in the bank, because money doesn't make you happy. It helps a lot, but it doesn't make you happy.
Yeah.
Well, the perfect spot here for the runway, I remember growing up here on the lake, and we used to come across to like the islands in Natini, and we used to see planes taking off, and it was just, this is so cool. Like, I can imagine, I've seen photos around the building at the moment, and it's just like the skydiving photos. It's just like you got the beach one side, the lake that side, you can see the power stations right out to like the mountains.
Yeah.
It's like the location here is amazing.
Yeah. I fly all around the world and it doesn't beat here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So, well, thanks for coming on. But before we go, if people want to, you know, reach out to you or, you know, come out here and go for a joy flight with you,
yep,
pass
yep
on your details.
Yeah, just matthallracing.com. You know, it's go on our website. It's got everything about us. So yep, if you want to, you know, buy a, you know, go somewhere or go for a joy flight, have an air race experience where I'll take you through high G turns and everything like that. It's all here.
Yeah.
If you just want to come and say good day and shake my hand.
Yeah.
I'm here most days.
Instagram, Facebook, have you got that sort of jazz?
Yeah, we do. I have no idea because I've got
the girls sort
the girls, yeah. Okay, so sweet, that's so why I employ people, because I still I'm a doer and I hate all that other stuff.
Yeah, sick.
Yeah, that's right. Awesome. Is there a weight limit for these flights?
Yeah, is there a weight limit? Because Matt and I are pretty chunky.
You'd be fine.
Yeah, because
yeah,
yeah. I looked at it a while ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was parachuting, wasn't it? Yeah, skydiving is a weight limit.
Yeah, well, we do have a weight limit, but if you can fit in, you're under the weight limit, yeah. And the good news is you'll get out less. Well, eat bananas in the morning, because bananas, one, you can blow them out, and two, they taste the same when they come out.
You can blow them out?
Yeah. No, I'm definitely keen. So when my wife listens to this, this is what I want for my birthday.
Right. Hey.
Before we go, can we go out for a walk out to see your planes?
Yeah, for sure.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Let's awesome go do it.
So all our listeners out there, suck eggs. We're going out and look at these planes.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Thanks for coming on. And you know, thanks for giving us your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having
thank
me.
Thank you very
that's
much.
Been a great chat.
Awesome. Cheers, Matt. Legend.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers.
Matthew Morris, how was that podcast?
Mate, Matt Hall is one of those people you just go, holy fuck.
Man, the shit he was saying, I was generally smiling. It was hectic.
And as we spoke about, we didn't realize, you know, a few weeks ago, we need to find someone that was
dropping bombs
over Baghdad, or, you know, dropping bombs in Afghanistan, you know, as a fighter pilot. We didn't realize that he was that guy.
Yeah, right under our noses.
Right under
our
noses.
In Newcastle, of all places.
And he spoke about, you know, him dropping more bombs than
the Australian Air Force.
Yeah. Which is absolutely hectic. And then, you know, obviously leaving the Air Force and then becoming essentially the best pilot in the world.
Yeah, Matt Hall Racing.
Yeah, Matt Hall Racing.
So he was good. Like, he was a genuine nice fella. And after the podcast, now he went out to see his planes and...
Yeah, so as he said before, you know, if you want to get in contact with him, you can either drop into his airfield and just say good day, because he reckons he's there most of the days.
Save for photos, handshakes. Yeah. He's cool.
Otherwise, you can chase him on, you know, social media, Instagram, Facebook, etc. It's Matt Hall Racing. And, you know, for us, if you want to listen to any of our podcasts, our past podcasts, just jump on to Instagram or Facebook. You'll find us at Zero Limits Podcast. Otherwise, do a search on your Apple Podcasts,
Spotify, Stitcher,
Google Podcasts, and all of them. There's a few other ones that I'm not even sure what they are.
They're out there.
But we're there. So anyway.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening.
Catch ya.
Ciao.
Wait. Now, quickly, just before you go, I want to tell you about Three Zeros Coffee. Now, as you know, I like my coffee how I like my men, long and black. However, lately, I've moved into the cold brews. I'm loving it, obviously, because the weather here in Australia at the moment is quite hot. So what I've been doing is using the Seasoned Campaigner pour-over filter bags. Literally rip open the packet, put the filter bag over my coffee mug, few ice cubes, pour in some hot water, let it cool down, add a sugar or two just to make it sweet, and I fucking love them. Honestly, you get the kick that you need out of the caffeine, and the taste is great. So if you want to get yourself a supply of coffee, head over to 30scoffee.com.au. From there, you can choose whatever you want. You've got the beans, you've got the pour-over filter bags, got some merchandise, and just to let you know that a percentage of their sales is forwarded to organisations that support first responders. So while you're getting your coffee, you're doing a good deed by getting some of this money to the first responders and where it needs to go. While you're there, don't forget to use the discount code 3ZLimits. Now, look in our bio, you see that discount code, use it, get your discounts. So again, jump onto 3zscoffee.com.au and grab yourself a supply.